Now we're talking to two people who have brought practices of mindfulness and meditation to a young audience, elementary school students.
It's an idea that's been getting some attention lately, replacing traditional punitive treatment in schools with meditation. Stories about this have gone viral online. Ali Smith founded an organization that asked kids who misbehaved to meditate rather than giving them detention. The program, when implemented in a Baltimore public elementary school, saw a drop in suspension rates.
Ali Smith is co-founder and executive director of the Holistic Life Foundation in Baltimore. Ali, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Principal Sarah Galanter-Gushevsky also joins us. She's principal at Glenn Stevens Elementary School in Madison, and she's worked in partnership with UW-Madison-based research group Center for Investigating Healthy Minds. And Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Sarah and Aliyah, can you give me an idea what we're saying when we talk about mindfulness in this context? Ali, we'll start with you.
To the Holistic Life Foundation, I guess we define mindfulness as practices that improve centering awareness and presence. Knowing what center is and being able to get back to it, the awareness of your thoughts, your actions, your emotions, your surrounding, and just present, just that feeling of being able to be in the present moment for as long as possible and not worry about the past or the future. And there's lots of different ways to do it.
And Ali, why teach mindfulness to kids when they're so young? I mean, we all know that when you first start out, meditation can be pretty difficult. It's not always that easy to do, to sit still. How does it go over with these young kids?
It's going great. I mean, we do a lot of different things to prepare them to be able to sit and meditate. We use breath work. We actually use movement first to help them slow their bodies down and be aware of their bodies and be able to sit still. Then we use breath work to help them kind of be able to slow their minds down a little bit. Then the transition into meditation becomes really, really seamless and simple.
And Sarah, you've experienced this firsthand as principal at Glenn Stevens Elementary School in Madison, and your program is called Movin' Minds. Can you tell me a little bit about how the program works?
Sure. So Movin' Minds is our school-wide, preventative intervention for all of our students and staff to allow them some time each day over the announcements to hear positive messages, to take that moment to take some deep breaths and to kind of learn some practices that they can then use later in situations that are stressful to them.
Sarah, why did you decide you wanted to bring this into your school? We hear a lot about how there's not enough time in the school day and kids and teachers are crunched to learn what they have to learn in a day. So why add one more thing?
So several years ago, we had a group of staff coming together. As from parents, we were hearing more and more about anxiety and stress at home, from staff their own stress, and then stress of the students in their classrooms. And so during a summer meeting, we brought people together and brainstormed what could we do, and by taking some time preventatively to be able to gain time by having kids be able to take care of themselves when they're feeling stressed instead of acting out.
So you have it sounds like, at one point after announcements over the loudspeaker. So is everybody at the school is practicing a little bit of meditation together in the morning?
That's right. So we've moved the time of day several times, but the practice has continued over the years where the entire school stops and takes time for a few breaths. We've done some different things. We've read visualizations. We have had kids just practicing breathing. We've had music that everybody has. So we've tried some different ways, and we're always modifying and adjusting it. But it is something that is the entire school at the same time.
And Ali, I want to ask you, you've been working on this. You work with some schools here in Wisconsin, but you've also done a lot of work in Baltimore. Can this effect be pretty dramatic when you have a bunch of kids given the opportunity to learn meditation and then meditate together? What happens?
I think it changes the entire school environment. You have a group of kids who may be used to dealing with anger or stress or worry or fear in certain ways that they've learned, however, whether it's at home or in their community or on TV or whatever, and they get different skills for self-regulation. And then I think one of the coolest things to see about the practice is first they learn to connect with themselves and love themselves, and they start to care about and become more compassionate about their peers in their school. I mean, you can't ask someone who doesn't really care about themselves to care about the people around them. So once they kind of care about themselves, it starts to ripple out from there. And then you actually see it start to build camaraderie and friendship and love and understanding with their peers. And the fights go down, the negative interactions go down, and the school becomes a lot more harmonious place.
Ollie, I know this is not just something you ended up doing by chance. This is personal to you. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started on this path?
Me and my brother are two of the co-founders of the organization, and we grew up with parents who were into meditation. So my dad would have me and my brother meditate before school in the mornings. And then in college, we met Andy Gonzalez, the third co-founder of the organization. And then we kind of jumped back on the path there. We connected with me and Ottman's godfather and really got deep into our practice then. So, I mean, it's been kind of cool to have community around it the entire time I've been through. And I think that was what made us want to do the Holistic Life Foundation and create a larger community around people who were into mindfulness practices and meditation and breath work and yoga and things along those lines.
We're talking right now with Ollie Smith, Executive Director, co-founder of Holistic Life Foundation, talking about how they're working to teach mindfulness strategies to young people. And also with us is Sarah Galanter-Gushevsky, principal of Glenn Stevens Elementary School. And they have done some of these mindfulness things there in the school and are seeing some results.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does your kid go to a school that uses some form of mindfulness as a strategy, maybe for discipline, for a more harmonious school environment? Would you like to see this happen? Do you work in a school? Does this sound like a good idea to you? Are you doing something like this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now to Sarah Galanter-Gushevsky, principal of Glenn Stevens Elementary School in Madison, Wisconsin, and Ollie Smith, executive director and co-founder of Holistic Life Foundation, about how they're working to teach mindfulness strategies to young people in some Madison public schools. And I want to get back to Glenn Stevens in just a bit. But first, Ollie, I do want to ask you, you know, yesterday on this program, we talked about how middle school can be difficult. It can be a time of social anxiety and heightened bullying and academic performance that can sometimes suffer because of, you know, the leap from elementary school to middle school. I started meditating pretty young, and I think it made a big difference in my life. And I'm curious about why you think it works in particular at these sort of stress points in people's lives and in students' lives. What is it about meditation, or in this case, mindfulness, that does it, do you think?
I think first it makes the young people aware of what stress is in their life. You know what I mean? I think a lot of times people are stressed out and they don't even know it. There's been kids that we know that realize, like a month into the practice, that they've been clenching their jaw and they haven't even known how long it's been for. You know what I mean? So I think the first thing is the awareness of, okay, my body is stressed out. This is how my body responds to stress. And this is how it makes me feel. This is where it manifests itself in my body. And then there's the tools that you can use, whether it's breath work or meditation or some mindful movement to help you relieve that stress. So I think it's the combination of the awareness and having the skills to be able to release it, which are the cool thing is they're lifelong tools. Like, life just gets more stressful as you get older. So the earlier you can get these practices, the better off you are with dealing with stress in your life.
And Sarah, what have you seen at your school? I mean, if you could share a story of a teacher or student who's been affected, what are you seeing?
I mean, as we survey students, we often hear kids saying that they are using their Move in Minds practice during sports, when they're getting ready for tests, when they're at pivotal times that they realize that they need to get a little more in control. We find that kids are encountering stressful situations and they're able to calm down faster, return to class faster, and get on to their learning. And I guess the one story that sticks out for me is a parent who sent an email saying, you know, I was really stressed and I was yelling at my child, and basically they told me, Mom, you need to do Move in Minds practice. You need to take some deep breaths, and it'll make you feel a lot better. And I think that our kids are able to teach that to their parents, that's what sticks with me. It's sticking with them, and they they're understanding it.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of research now and media coverage of the benefits of all different kinds of meditation right now, but it's not something that parents necessarily grew up with. I'm wondering if kids are maybe at the leading edge of this in a way, certainly in a school setting like this. So do you ever have to educate the parents about why this has value?
Absolutely. We've done some different parent nights. We started our first PTO meeting of the year doing some breathing exercises to show them what we're doing here at school. And during in our monthly newsletter, we update people about why our Move in Mind practice is important. And I think that, you know, as it's in the media as well, I think people are starting to ask questions and trying to find out more information.
And Ollie, I'm curious because I imagine with these kids, this is sort of just dipping the toes into the waters of meditation. You can go really, really deeply into meditation practices. Do you ever see that with these students as they progress, that they may start doing a couple breath exercises and awareness exercises, but then you know maybe it launches them into a deeper practice somehow?
Yeah, actually, a lot of the students that we started with in 2002 when we started the Holistic Life Foundation are actually currently employed as yoga and mindfulness instructors for the Holistic Life Foundation. So, I mean, they were like 10 or so when we met them in fifth grade, and now they're like 25-year-old young men, and they're all teaching. This is what they do for a living, is they teach yoga and mindfulness to other kids all over the country at this point.
Wow. Well, I'm wondering for people who this is still pretty new to them, could you give us maybe just a taste or an exercise that maybe we can try at home that would give us an idea about what we're talking about and maybe give some benefit too?
Sure. I mean, I guess the easiest thing is taking a belly breath. Most people are chest breathers, and they don't know how to take a deep breath. A deep breath works physiologically and neurologically to help your body in a lot of different ways. I guess the easiest thing it does, it helps to slow down your heart and slow down your mind and slow down your thoughts. Easy way to do that practice is if you sit up nice and straight and you root your feet in the floor, you can take your right hand and put it on your belly. All the breathing is going to be in and out through your nose. And just a simple way to learn how to take a belly breath is to put your right hand on your belly, like I said, and just inhale through your nose and expand your belly as much as you can. Really fill your belly up with air. Then leave your hand where it is and exhale and pull your belly away from your hand, creating space between your belly and your hand, and squeeze your belly in. Imagine you're pulling your belly button to your spine. Then inhale and fill your belly back up, all the way out until it touches your hand again. Then exhale and squeeze your belly in, pull it away from your hand, create space between your belly and your hand. Imagine you're pulling your belly button to your spine again. Then you'll inhale and fill your belly again, all the way out to your hand. Exhale, squeeze your belly in, push all that air out. Again, imagine you're pulling your belly button to your spine. And one more deep one, inhale and fill your belly again. All the way back out to your hand, close that space out, and exhale and squeeze your belly in, push all that air out again.
That feels pretty good in the middle of a pledge drive.
Right? You can slow everything down a little bit, mentally and physically.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I really appreciate that. Ollie Smith there and Sarah Galanter-Gushevsky, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That was Ollie Smith, co-founder and executive director of Holistic Life Foundation, and Sarah Galanter-Gushevsky, principal of Glenn Stevens Elementary School in Madison, Wisconsin, talking about the efforts to teach meditation to children in schools.
We learned something once again on Central Time. I know I did. Pledge in support of these informative conversations right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest grew up loving math and numbers, and she turned that love of math into a career, first in the academic world and then in business as a number cruncher for a hedge fund. She says that experience opened her eyes to the way math is misused and abused in our society.
In her new book, she says we need to pay more attention to the way mathematical algorithms are used to determine who gets jobs and keeps jobs, who goes to jail and who doesn't, who gets loans and who gets targeted by predatory lenders. And she says when you add it all up, these algorithms end up stacking the deck against poor people and people of color.
Kathy O'Neill joins us now. She's a data scientist and author of the blog Math Babe. Her new book is Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, leading up to your book, you've got this lifelong love of math. You went from using your math skills for a hedge fund to teaching financial math to Occupy Wall Street protesters. What led you to this huge change?
Well, I would frame it more like I joined Occupy, and part uh-huh. of joining Occupy is sharing knowledge. I guess the short version is I was extremely disillusioned by working in finance. I had this naive, idealistic concept leaving academics in 2007 that I could bring sort of the beauty and honesty and clarity of mathematics to the real world in finance. But when I got there, I realized that there were like a bunch of mathematical lies, and there's a really big mathematical lie in the heart of the financial crisis, namely the AAA ratings of mortgage-backed securities. Those were, you know, supposed to be mathematical risk ratings. They were supposed to be performed by, you know, mathematicians, math PhDs in the back room of the credit rating agencies, sort of diligently going over the data that they had and making sure that things were very low risk. And that was a lie. That in fact they knew that the mortgage-backed securities were extremely toxic, and they were selling those ratings, but they were calling it mathematical, and it was kind of a weaponized form of mathematics that I was really ashamed of.
And so you went out in search of other forms on your Math Babe blog, and now in the book Weapons of Math Destruction. And a lot of what you're talking about in the book is the way we as a society in so many different walks of life use algorithms to make important decisions. Before we get into specific examples, give us a 101. What is an algorithm? How do they function in our lives?
Great question. An algorithm is simply a process, usually a decision-making process. Often in the examples I give in the book, they're scoring processes. But the way you build an algorithm is that you provide a bunch of historical data where you can look for patterns, and then some kind of definition of success. So you're looking for patterns for that definition of success. So you might be looking for the perfect job candidate to hire, and then you give the historical data you would give is like the history of all the people that ever applied to your company, and the definition of success, which you would be in charge of defining, would be something like that person stays at the company for 5 years and is promoted twice. And then what the algorithm would do when you train it on that historical data set is it would look for patterns in historical data that would indicate somebody who is going to be successful with that definition.
And somebody might look at that, and you're right, many people have looked at that idea of this mathematical way to evaluate a job candidate or a lot of other things that we'll get into and say, well, that's great. Because, you know, the old sloppy way you had people, they had biases, they might have discriminated. Now we're going to math this out and have this perfectly objective way of evaluating candidates. And that's where we run into trouble, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, like, just in the example I just gave, I mean, there's no reason to think that algorithm trained on historical data would be in any way objective, right? All it would do, and all algorithms do, is pattern match. So it would just simply find the patterns of your company's past practices, and it would predict that those patterns will be repeated. So if your company had a history of being, you know, of discriminating against women for hiring and engineering jobs, for example, or if your company once they hired women, didn't let them succeed by the definition of success that you chose, then that algorithm would pattern match and would filter out women as potentially unsuccessful. So there's the number one thing I wish to do with my book is to slam home the fact that algorithms are not inherently objective. They are biased. The data they're given is often biased itself, but also they have embedded values of the person building the model, because one of the things you do, again, is you define success. And success is, you know, a value judgment.
I think in the earlier days of programming, I remember the phrase, and it kept coming back to me as I looked at your book, garbage in, garbage out, meaning flaws that went into your programming would lead to flaws in your output. It sounds like we're just recreating that, but now on a level that's really affecting a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, that's a really important point. So sometimes when you say garbage in, garbage out, you actually mean, like, if you have bad data or dirty data or inaccurate data, then you have inaccurate output. And that's, of course, true. But what we also see is what you just mentioned, that if you have bias data, which is to say you have, you know, hiring practices in our example, that were already flawed, then what you're going to do is train the algorithm to repeat the past. You're just propagating forward in time the historical patterns. Which is to say, if we had a perfect and fair process by which to hire people, we would want to automate that. We would, because it would save time and money. But until we have something that's perfect, automating it is the same thing as just propagating those patterns.
Talking to Kathy O'Neill, her new book is called Weapons of Math Destruction. That's Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy, I want to get into some more examples now. Crime and punishment is a place, and this has been in the news some over the last few months, of ways algorithms get used. One that got a lot of attention was in sentencing. How do we evaluate somebody, their likelihood to commit a new crime, how long they should be put in jail? How are algorithms going into that and recreating, as you say, the biases that were already there?
Right. So the most important thing you have to understand is that every criminal defendant is being given a score, a recidivism score, the likelihood of them returning to prison after they leave after 2 years. And I should say that 97% of prisoners eventually leave prison, so this is an important question. But what's critical to understand is that if people are assigned a higher risk score, then they, generally speaking, get put in prison for longer. So there's a real consequence to getting these high risk scores. So we have to be very careful that these risk scores are being built fairly. And that's what my concern is that the kind of data that goes into those scores is highly biased against poor people and against people of color. So there's every reason to think that people are assigned these high-risk scores by dint of their demographics rather than their actual behavior.
And another, staying with crime and punishment for a moment, another algorithm that gets used is, hey, where should we put police? Where should we prioritize law enforcement to prevent crimes? Which, again, sounds like a good thing. The consequence, you say, though, is that police end up being in areas, again, with poor people, often with people of color. And those people then, for a minor crime, a public intoxication or something like that, are more subject to a police encounter than someone, say, on a university campus would be with the same behavior. And that ends up haunting them in a lot of other algorithms down the road.
Exactly right. And it's for the reasons I already laid out for the hiring algorithm. All these algorithms really do is pattern match. So if we have a pattern of police finding crimes, nuisance crimes, crimes of poverty or mental health problems or addiction, if they have a pattern of doing that in certain neighborhoods, which they do because of the broken windows policies we have all over the country, then the algorithms, which are supposed to be scientific, basically just give an excuse for police to go back to those same neighborhoods and continue to over-police them. One of the thought experiments I like to share in this realm is the idea that after the financial crisis, we could have sent all the police down to Wall Street to arrest the bankers and to harass their friends, which would be sort of the equivalent of the gang members that we talk about when we talk about like poor black neighborhoods. And they would have found a lot of street drugs on those guys. And then the predictive policing algorithm with that kind of data would have said, oh, police, you should go back to Wall Street because that's where the criminals are. But since we never did that, we're simply repeating the past practices of the police.
And that reminds me, and when you talk about another realm of algorithms that is popular, teacher evaluation, trying to come up with objective ways to rate teachers, led to some teachers being fired, in effect, based in part on their algorithm evaluations. One problem, among the problems you see with that, is that there's no checkup, there's no feedback, there's no looking back and saying, okay, are we getting better teachers because of this? Are we firing the right people, keeping the right people? That's a common problem with this use of algorithms.
That's right. One of the fundamental characteristics of a really successful algorithm is that it gets better over time. And the way it gets better over time is that it's compared to some kind of ground truth. So, for example, if Amazon shows me a product that Amazon thinks that I might be interested in, but I never click on it, nor does anybody else who has a similar shopping history to mine, then Amazon eventually, their algorithm learns not to show that. It's just not a winner. So it updates its algorithm. The problem, one of the problems with the teaching algorithm is that it was its own reality. There was no ground truth against which these scores were compared. And so there was no way to know what the model was doing well or to improve it. And in particular, and it didn't get improved, and it was actually not an accurate model.
I want to track a little bit of a lifespan of a low-income person, maybe person of color, and how they encounter algorithms. You're low-income, you're from a low-income neighborhood, which might lead it to be harder for you to get a job. You have more police encounters based on algorithms, which makes it harder to get a job. These things end up going on your credit score because you can't get a job. That makes it harder to get a job in the future. These things all keep reinforcing each other. Harder to get a mortgage makes you more the target, you say in the book, of predatory lenders. It snowballs. It never ends, does it?
That's right. And I should mention that a lot of the minimum wage jobs have, in addition to what you just mentioned, they have these excruciating personality tests that you have to take that filter out 85% of the people who apply. And then once you have a job, a lot of the minimum wage job workers are subject to these crazy scheduling algorithms that prevent them from having regular schedules and from getting a second job or going to school at night. So it's a real problem, and it's a kind of a secret, invisible problem, because for the most part, the technologists like myself, we don't see the suffering when we develop these models. We see it as sorting the winners over the losers, but we're mostly the winners. And that's one of the reasons I decided to write the book, because I just thought it's like a financial crisis, except that nobody will notice. And so I wanted to make sure people are aware of these issues.
So our society loves big data. It loves objective, or what appear to be objective, measures. It seems like corporate decision makers, government policy makers all over the place are wanting to do more and more of this. How do you see us either reversing that trend or at least continuing it with algorithms that actually work?
Well, I agree. It's going to be tough because a lot of these algorithms make just a ton of money for the companies in question. Those scheduling algorithms I mentioned, one of the constraints that you can put into the algorithm is to keep people from having enough hours per week to qualify for benefits. And that really does, it does actually benefit the company who uses it. So to some extent, I'm asking for increased regulation, and in particular, modified laws from the anti-discrimination laws that were built in the 70s, that were written in the 70s, but haven't really incorporated the new kinds of methods that the big data companies can employ. Other examples, I think maybe the data companies will start paying more attention to, because to some extent, I want to be fair, I don't think that all the people who are working within the industry of big data are really aware of all these problems. So I'm hoping for some people to do the right thing.
We'll leave it there, Kathy. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Kathy O'Neill, data scientist and author of the new book, Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy.